Welcome to A New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital, and I am here this afternoon with Diane Damsky. Diane is a seasoned executive with strong investment management, capital markets, and impact investing skills. She was and is instrumental in creating impact investing standards and practices around environmental, social, and governance, ESG integration, as you'll also find out on the impact side. Her work can be seen in the 9 impact principles that 166 signatories have signed on under the operating principles for impact management. If I said anything wrong there, I'm sure you'll correct me, but welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Jeff. We're at 170.
Okay, 170.
Signatories, and it represents more than $500 billion in impact assets, which is more than half of the impact market estimated last year.
So we will get into that. Thank you for that clarification. No. That's awesome. But before we get into that, which ultimately I want to get into that, give us a little background on who you are, maybe where you grew up, a little about your career, where you went to school, and then from where we'll dive into what you're doing today.
I grew up in Michigan. I was born in Ohio, but I basically grew up in Michigan. So I consider myself a Michigander. And then I went to Washington, D.C. for college. I went to Georgetown in the School of Foreign Service as a Russian studies major. Why? I can't really answer that question, but I was always interested in languages, spoke French, and then I took Russian. After that, this was in the Cold War. After that, I traveled around Eastern Europe and these countries to see what I wanted to do for a career because I didn't want to work for the government. And through my languages, I ended up in banking. So there was no grand plan. That is how I got into finance. I started my career in New York for 18 years in emerging markets before they existed. And then I lent the money. I restructured the debt. I represented countries restructuring their debt. And then I ended up trading this debt. And then I ended up on the buy side investing in this debt. So I did the whole life cycle for emerging market debt. And we never knew where that market was going. We had no idea it was going to be this, you know, multi-billion dollar market that it's become. But that's really kind of my career as far as how did I get into finance. From there, after some of you can recall the Russia crisis, LT, long-term capital management, and there were just so many crises, waking up at 4 in the morning to manage a portfolio just became not incredibly appealing. So I moved from New York to Florida to get into wealth management and worked for a few firms down in Miami, worked a lot with Latin America. So that got my Spanish skills all brushed up. And then Miami is a wonderful place, but it's very close to South America and not very close to the rest of the United States. And I really wanted to be closer to family in Michigan. So I moved to DC in 2009 in the midst of the global meltdown of the banking systems. But I got a job at JP Morgan in Washington, DC to continue the wealth management. Where am I? 7 years after JP Morgan, I realized I really do want to do something in the public sector and got a position with the CFO at the World Bank. And that was when they were really focused on mobilizing more private capital. Mm-hmm. And this was particularly for infrastructure projects in emerging markets. I met people at IFC that were focused on impact and really saying, how do we get the impact market to grow, to be more disciplined, to not kind of melt into all the other investing for goods? And I went over to IFC, and that's where I got involved with writing the standards for the impact market.
This is why I love interviewing people, because your story and your history and your experience is so unique, as is everybody. So, yeah, I always love when people say, you know, how did you get to where you're at? And, you know, and you talk to a student in college, you're like, oh, yeah, I know I'm going to do this, this and this. And so you hear right. Your story as it was mine. It's like, yeah, I don't think you could have scripted it. And I'm imagining you couldn't have scripted where you're at today.
No, there was no grand plan, but I followed my passions and what I wanted to focus on. And I am so excited that I ended up in the impact space. I will say that when I was at JP Morgan, it was really starting to become apparent that there were more and more clients that wanted to do more with their capital than just get a return. And this was, we started a women's focus group. So we took all the men out of the room. We brought in their partners, their wives, their children. And the conversation with women was decidedly different than it was with the men. They focused on families, generational wealth, the environment, education, social impact themes. And that really spurred me to want to be able to do something else. So when I had the opportunity to work on the impact principles, I was so excited. I said, this is what people have been clamoring for a long time.
So you just obviously talked about one of the trends that you know about it, but in the industry, this transfer of wealth to women and then the next generation, you're experiencing it firsthand just how the next who are in control have a differing passion, mandate, whatever you want to say, towards capital. I'd be curious, and I'm going to jump back in your career just a little bit. So this whole idea of emerging market credit, I'd be curious if you give us a snippet of like what it was like, wherever far back you can go, and then what it looks like today, just to give us some perspective, because you sat in a very interesting spot.
Probably my favorite job was my first job at Manufacturers Hanover Trust, for those of you that can remember. And so at Manny Hanny, I worked with North Africa. And at that time, the only people in North Africa were, there were commercial banks, and you also had the IMF and World Bank. I was lending to Mauritania, for example, which didn't even qualify for World Bank lending. We were making a difference in countries and providing capital to countries that were still, they were on the cusp. They really needed more governmental help, but they still had to have letters of credit for financing oil imports, sugar, tea, whatever it is. So you really felt like you made a difference. It's different than today. We were in markets that were fairly untapped. They were emerging markets before that term was even coined, but you really felt like you were doing something good. And I so love that about working with this part of the world.
Did you actually see good things happen? Because the cynic goes, you know what? But that either A, investors didn't get in return back, or it didn't even make a difference. So I'd be curious if you actually go, no, we saw real differences when this capital was invested.
These were critical imports that we were confirming letters of credit for. I mean, it was to keep the country going. You made a big difference, because if you didn't confirm these letters of credit, they weren't going to get the oil that they needed. Or, you know, and also we financed grain exports for Exim. Exim had guarantees. So we'd finance grain into Morocco, which was a huge staple. In these countries, some of these imports were to feed the people as well as to keep the country going. So, and again, Africa was kind of maybe, it was a little bit of a different situation than when in Latin America, which at that time was starting to just restructure one after another after another. So there wasn't the kind of millions of loans made to Africa as there had been in South America. It was a different kind of lending. It was a lot of short-term credit to keep the countries and their working capital going. But it was a great time, because we all loved what we did. There were, half of my colleagues had been in the Peace Corps, and they loved that region. So that's why they got into banking.
You obviously came at this from a financial standpoint, although, you know, you just mentioned people, the Peace Corps and whatnot. So I'd love to hear from you. The stereotype that we often hear in America is, how do you actually make money and do good? I'd love to hear your answer to that question when somebody goes, wait, impact investing, how do you make money and do good?
It's really two prongs, because first of all, impact investing is unlike other types of investing. It is patient capital. If you're going to have an impact that's measurable, this isn't a short-term transaction. You are committed to doing something over the long term and sustaining your investment so that you can actually achieve the impact that you're targeting. That's a huge difference. But beyond, let's say you're in a private equity deal that you exit in 10 years, you want to sustain the impact achieved as long as possible. So what impact investors do, they can write it into their documentation. They can have that affect the negotiations they're having with the buyer. More importantly, that's the immediate impact that you're making. There is a long-term, unquantifiable impact that quite often exists with all of these investments, because it's almost a snowball effect. Let's say you're building a hospital in some area and they're underserved. So then the hospital is built, which attracts more, there's more employment, and then you're getting roads built to the hospital, and then you're getting financial centers and financial banks being built, and then schools. And that kind of a long-term sustainable impact is unquantifiable. And I think that's what people miss when you're looking at impact investing. Yes, there's the immediate impact, but what you're doing has long-term beneficial effects for all of the beneficiaries in the community that in which you're investing that you may not be able to quantify until later on in time. And that's the beauty of impact investing, because you're really trying to set things up with the future in mind, not just for that investment.
How would you frame up for the listener the difference between ESG and impact, especially as ESG is in the news a lot today?
I have to present this at almost any conference that where I'm speaking, and people that are not in the impact bubble 24/7 as I am. ESG is really risk mitigation. You are monitoring an investment for the potential effects, negative effects of an investment. So ESG is the foundation for impact. You can't talk about having a positive impact if you're not first going to monitor for the potential negative effects of that investment. So ESG is that foundation, and it's critical. That's in the impact principles. We have 9 principles. That is principle 5. Beyond that, impact has a level of rigor that includes intentionality. You must target an intentional impact at the outset of an investment. Contribution, you must be able to articulate how your capital affects the impact achieved or contributes to the impact mm-hmm. achieved. And then you must be able to measure the impact. So while people sometimes in the ESG space speak about, oh, we're having an impact, you can have an ESG with an ex post impact, meaning you're not setting it out. You're like, well, we're going to be doing something good for the environment, but you're not targeting an intentional impact. You're not talking about how your capital is directly contributing to that impact, but you can measure the impact you had at the end. Sure. And that's great. There's no value judgment, but they are different. Impact has a level of rigor, and it's the whole life cycle of an investment.
I'm a bit biased because I think on the private side, where you have more control of the investment itself and what it's doing, I think it lends itself more towards impact investing as you described it. Not to say that you can't on the public side, but it's just the disconnect is a little bit harder.
You're absolutely correct. It is much easier to do impact investing in private markets. Again, I started this saying it's patient capital.
Yeah.
Patient tends to be a longer term investment. It's also you can have more of a direct effect if you're directly investing in the companies.
Yep.
You can have more of a direct effect on your end investee. The public markets, it's possible, but it's very hard. The intentionality and contribution piece are much harder in the publicly traded equity yeah. space. On the publicly traded debt space, if you're working in the primary markets, it is possible. And you're seeing more impact investors in the muni market. And now there's sustainability linked bonds and there are yep. impact bonds. So all of those, it might be a little bit easier, but it's not a generic fixed income portfolio where you're just adding a bunch of secondary market securities. So it's still a little bit more challenging. So I agree with you.
I'm assuming in some of these questions that you will talk about the 9 principles. If you don't, I'll come back around and make sure that we talk a little bit about what your baby has been at least however long, the last 7 years, whatever the math is.
4 years.
Four years. Okay. How would you best describe yourself in the context of where you're at in your life journey?
That's a very deep question. I would say, you know, as I describe my career, I see that this was one, I went to the public sector to try to make a difference and contribute to something that is important. I had no idea that I was actually going to be involved in writing the principles for impact investors to set a standard for global impact investors. So that to me was beyond what I had envisioned being able to do at the World Bank and IFC. I'm kind of at that stage of my career where I'm doing something that I feel is very important for the markets long term. And now I have so much skill and experience, I want to be able to continue to contribute to this, particularly in the impact space. And the reason I've been able to manage this, I've been head of the secretariat. Once we launched them in April 2019, somebody had to manage them and oversee them and continue to promote them. Because I had a long career in financial services, I'm very able to reach out to the private sector to manage these relationships, to talk about the legal aspects. And I know documentation. I know how operations work. So it was just a seamless transition for me. So where am I at my life journey? If I look at my life journey is one thing, but my career, I think this is kind of the pinnacle of my career. Everything just came together and all of my skills have made me able to make this the success that it's been.
So why don't you explain what you have been working on the last 4 years so people can understand, you know, what you're alluding to here?
most people already know about ESG and incorporating ESG considerations into an investment. That's how the Principles for Responsible Investing came about. There had to be some guidelines. So the PRI are there for ESG considerations in investing. You had the green bond principles for the green bonds. There was nothing for impact. 2018, when we started this process, impact was starting to just kind of get dissolved into everything else. It was one big stew pot of investing for good. Impact investors are like, no, it's different. This is not good. And particularly the development finance institutions like the World Bank, IFC, EBRD, this is what they do. And for this standard to start to become something else that it shouldn't be was of concern. So IFC raised its hand to say, we need a standard for impact investing. And that was the genesis of this initiative to write the Operating Principles for Impact Management, which were launched in 2019. These principles are really a framework to ensure investors incorporate impact throughout the life of an investment. It's all about the impact management system and the processes that you have in place to ensure that you're investing for impact. So we wrote them. We had 58 investors at the launch. Now we have 170. And while we thought it was important, it's become greater than just signing, being a signatory, because what they require is all of the signatories must publish on an annual basis a disclosure statement. And they describe in that statement how their impact management systems and processes align with each of the impact principles. There's also a requirement for independent verification periodically. It's usually between every 1 to 4 years. And that's that there's some other party that affirms that you, in fact, are doing what you say you do. And the reason we added that is, one, we had to reduce the risk of impact washing. Mm-hmm. And two, that was one of the concerns that signatories had about other principles that are out there. It's like, you can say things, but you may or may not, it may or may not be true. It may or may not be true in the way you say it is. So there had to be, because of the risk of impact washing and truly distinguishing what is impact investing, we had to have that. It's principle 9, the independent verification. For those in the impact space, already I'm telling you something that you know quite well, but the impact space is the most collaborative, generous group of organizations I have ever worked with in my life. These are natural competitors that are fighting for the same capital that will get around a table and talk about the challenges and best practices and how do we do this so that we make sure we all get it right and that the impact market is moving in the right direction and everybody's moving in the same direction, some variations on a theme, but it's truly incredible. And I feel very blessed to be in this space because it's unlike anything I've ever experienced in the financial world.
So I've been in the alternative space, alternative investment space, when I add impact into that for 25 plus years. And I just had a conversation the other day with a gentleman who was in the broader alternative space, and he was trying to get his arms wrapped around impact investing and like, well, is this company an impact and whatnot? And I actually should have used this as a data point where when you are an impact and asset manager, let's just say, yes, financial goals is clearly on that list and it's important. But I think one of the ways you tell it, how serious that company is by the collaboration that they are willing to engage in on their competitors. Because for me, when I switched to the impact space, it's what you said. I noticed how much people were to the broader mission that they wanted to get a room and figure this stuff out. Yes, they're still competitors and they're not divulging everything, but it wasn't just lip service that I got the first 20 years in the alt space where you talk to your competitor and they're nice to you and behind closed doors, they're absolutely eating you up. And it's just not that way. Now, I'm sure there's some of that, but it's a way different feel to me because there's a bigger calling. And you just affirmed that. It's a great point that I don't bring up enough, but I've experienced it firsthand myself. Where could somebody go to find these principles?
Well, that's very easy. And thank you for that. Our website is www.impactprinciples.org. That website is really a repository for all kinds of resources for people interested in impact. So we publish others' publications, we articles, news about updates on our signatories or updates about the market. There's also a list of all of the signatories. And on that, it's on the signatories tab. If you go to it, you will see all of, we probably have 140, I think, disclosure statements posted now. Since it's the third year they've been done, I'm so impressed about how they have evolved over the first 3 years, because the first time nobody knew what they were doing. Nobody had ever done a disclosure statement before. So what's the model? Since then, though, you're seeing a rigor and level of information provided that is so helpful. The market is so much more transparent because of the impact principles and this disclosure requirement. People are talking about, they post links to their impact reports, links to their responsible investing policy, links to some of their in-house frameworks. And also what I'm seeing is the best practices develop around certain of the principles, which is fantastic. Because our goal is now, with all the collaboration with the signatories, is really to support the development of best practices so that we really have everybody going in a similar direction. So we don't mandate you have to use Iris Plus of the GIN for your impact metrics or HIPSO, which is what public sector institutions are doing. But that is the best practice. You're seeing that across the board. Everyone has some tailored metrics. That's fine. These are great universal metrics that everybody should use. This is still a relatively new market. So there's a lot of divergence around impact performance. And we're tackling it through impact reporting, because if we create some minimal level of standards for impact reports that every impact investor, I'm talking about investors only, have to include in theirs, then we are going to be able to compare across investors and investments. And that's the point of an impact report, so that there's more information that investors can use, that the market can use, and it brings more, again, discipline and rigor to the market.
How much do you all gather that information, collate it, and bring out nuggets and share that with outside the signatories?
We do a lot in-house. However, the first initiative to come out of the impact principles started at the launch. We were in a room for our first workshop, and everyone's like, we have to work on harmonization of impact metrics. So that became a two and a half year long working group between HIPSO, which is the Harmonized Indicators for Private Sector Operations of the IFCs, EBRDs of this world, and Iris Plus, and a few signatories. And what they did was they launched in 2021 the Joint Impact Indicators, which is a high-level set of core indicators across themes. And they started with jobs, gender, and climate. The goal is that we would like all impact investors that invest in these themes to use this set so that at some level, we're all speaking the same language and words all mean the same thing. They are going to continue to work with other sectors. But that was one of the first things, and that's public. On impact reporting, that is something that we would like to spread beyond the signatories, but we're starting with the signatory group. There's a working group on reporting under SFDR Article 9, and that's something that may just stay within the signatories. It's really up to them, but they may share these practices with others. So it's really up to the signatories how big they want it to be. I have done several webinars, which are posted on our website. So there's a lot of public information that is through the website as well.
Well, I could go down this path for a long time, but I'm gonna choose not to go a whole lot deeper in that, other than to say it is the standardization, getting people, I mean, standardization with principles, I think is really important, obviously, for this industry to continue to grow. So commend you and what you're doing. And then I'm also, it's amazing on the alternative investment side, which I said I've spent years in, it took quite a while to get any of these types of standards in place. And so I think most people are either ignorant or shocked to find how early on impact already has some best practices. So I'm anxious to continue to get what you're doing out there. Turning it to you a little bit more, just because of your unique experience, how would you say you're trying to change the world?
Impact investing is one way. I mean, really explaining to people what it means, because, you know, unless you're in it, when I say impact investing, everybody assumes they understand what that means. My goal is to just really enhance the understanding of what it means to invest for impact. Why is it important? Why is there a value to people doing it in the same way? So I feel that that's something I'd like to contribute and change the world, so to speak. But I think it's a huge contribution for all of us in this space. You know, there's an assumption that they understand, but what I find is they're still outside of my bubble. People still conflate it with ESG and they conflate it with sustainability. Impact is a subset of sustainable investing. It's a subset of ESG, but it's much more specific and it's tough. It is difficult to do. It requires specific systems. So it's a little bit more expensive to set up, but once you're there, the long-term benefit to the world is there.
Well, I just want to say, it was funny. I was on an email chain last week, and I won't go through all the details other than to say the email that I got back said, well, I'm not so sure that works because impact investing and 1031, this is 1031 investing or DST investing, like, you know, he's like, they don't even jive. And I'm like, no, you could actually use a 1031 and invest in something that has an impact mandate. And no, you actually could easily do that. In fact, if anything, they usually be long-term investment. I didn't get into it with this individual, but I'm like, yeah, there's a massive disconnect between what impact and investing ultimately is. When did you realize the power of capital and what does that mean to you?
Probably when I was a little kid and you realize you can afford things or you can't afford things. That's the power. That's the power of money. The power of capital, I think it was when I started, probably when it resonated with me was when I was working with the women, as I said, at JP Morgan and in these luncheons and events we would have with women and realize women's power through their capital it's underrepresented. Women don't understand quite often the power of their capital. And that was the goal of a lot of these organizations that have popped up about women own more homes than men in the United States. There's just a whole, there is a power of capital that might be underutilized in certain segments in the United States I can speak to. That to me is the power of capital. There's another side of the power of capital though. It's if you look at VC firms, female-led VC firms, they are undercapitalized because people want to invest with men, whatever the, you know, long-term biases are. So they don't have the same power as other VC firms because they're led by women. And we have to change that because there's a lot of wonderful managers out there of whatever gender. But I think the power of capital is where money flows to is really going to get the most attention and it can have the greatest benefits. So I'm hoping more money flows into impact so it has greater benefits for the planet.
What does stewardship mean to you?
To me, it means leaving the world in a better place than you got it. It's not just an investing thing. It's like we're all stewards for the successive generations and we're not doing a really good job, I have to say right now, you know.
Okay, we're going to close this out. And this is a big question. And so there's freedom in how you want to answer it. But if you could make one dream come true for your life, what would it be?
It's really having made a difference. I mean, for me, I always wanted to make a difference. So I want, when people think about me, I made a difference. It could be my daughter, you know, or it could be my legacy will be that people think about me in a positive way after I'm gone. So that's a dream that I won't see realized. I hope that my being on this planet had a net benefit for the people around me and people that I don't even know. The other dream would be to have enough money so that I can have a pied-à-terre in Paris and also a home in Spain and just travel everywhere. Because to me, experiencing other cultures and languages is a big part of who I am and why I've become the person that I am. So I just, you know, always learning and always experiencing different people.
Yeah, your concept of legacy, I'd say I'm shocked, but on one hand, I'm not. But I continue to be reaffirmed through our work with registered investment advisors all across the United States. And it's really encouraging to hear this is how more and more people are concerned about the legacy they leave their family, the next generation, community. And I think that's actually a big driver in this impact space is that they want their kids to see money being thought of slightly different than maybe what we have historically had. So I think your dream, I'm actually watching that becoming more and more of a reality, which is fun to see. And I will tell you, to get on the touchy-feely side, I've watched how when advisors plug into that, the joy and freedom that it brings to their clients and even themselves, it changes the conversation. Who doesn't get fired up? I mean, you pick it. I mean, whether it's, you know, lending to renewable energy in Africa, like, you know, my brother's doing some stuff like that, to know that the impact you're having on not only that generation, but generations to come, it's an honor to be able to use capital to do that.
This has been fun. I love talking about impact. I love talking about the impact principles. Anyone that understands impact, just keep spreading the word. It's really important. And we have to make sure everybody's on the same page and gets what we're trying to do. And Jeff, well, thank you so much for your time. This was great.
Appreciate your leadership. And I look forward to your principles going from whatever, 170 to 1,000 signatories on there. Don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. Please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. This will help new listeners find the show and hopefully put them on a path to a more fulfilling portfolio within the impact investing space. Until next time, I'm Jeff Schaefer. This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.